So I'm going to improvise a bit in this short interlude, simply because Patrick has brought up several, or has made several points, I guess, about the legacy that I do not need to repeat, unless perhaps because partially I don't feel qualified to go into great depth, because it doesn't really cover the extent of our research, particularly the point about where has this soft power operation moved to today, which would concern my question in terms of the legacy of the CCF at one level. Partially because I was then during his lecture thinking that maybe I should try to articulate something that has sort of come up as an idea in the process of research, but I haven't fully managed to develop, perhaps even grasp and think through in terms of the legacy of the CCF for artistic production in relation to the political role of art at large. And this is the question of the artistic critique, of what two sociologists have called the artistic critique. So I'll get there. I'll just make three notes, or three short excursions before in the few minutes I got. One is nothing but a sort of insertion in terms of, you know, I'm obviously myself too young to having been part of the Cold War battles that we do talk about here, but just in terms of atmosphere that you gather when you grow up in West Germany, as I did, I think very formative for me was the surrounding of the and the atmosphere of the peace movement and the anti-nuclear protests and the enormous chains of so-called Menschenketten running over kilometers up to the hundreds with candles protesting against the stationing of rockets in Western Germany. And it seems to me that this is obviously a peace movement very different from the peace movement earlier advocated by the Soviet Union. And there is, if any, few direct continuity between them. Since the peace movement that parts of me biographically may still have experienced is actually part of the, belongs to the legacy of the 68, which really was the grand rupture or decision in, I think, the story of the CCF as well. But that particular peace movement somehow probably received its final nail in the coffin with the bombing of NATO of Belgrade in the 90s and the consent of the Green Party to that bombardment. And that just seemed to me crucial somehow for a more local, perhaps personal understanding of one of these, of the other grand word, not freedom, but peace. In terms of freedom, I just wanted to remark also in terms of German politics is, of course, I think for each country, the situation is just as much as in the arts, also politically rather difficult, but of course different and needs to be distinguished. But I guess it makes sense to attempt to generalize to some degrees insofar as what concerns the legacy of the CCF. We speak certainly about a historical compromise that is right now and to different degrees since the mid-90s being deconstructed, being dismantled. And that historical compromise, to a certain degree, is the social democratic welfare state. In terms of the other grand word, freedom, I remembered while listening to Patrick reading a speech by Willy Brandt, who you encounter here at the introductory panel to the history of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, together with Martin Luther King, opening that CCF-sponsored 64 edition of the Berliner Festwochen. And 10 years later, in that very articulate and powerful speech, Brandt, whose very coalition government of free Democrats, liberals, and social Democrats may also be credited to a certain degree to the activities and the networks and the discourse formed by the CCF. And the CCF was directly involved in preparing and supporting such things as the Godesberg Conference that defined what social democracy in the post-war period was and is. In this speech, however, Brandt insists, speaking against the conservatives and their campaign, repeatedly using the same slogan, socialism versus socialism or freedom, insists that those very conservatives do not have the sole right to claim the terms freedom for themselves. And the argument he makes relates to the question of the artistic critique that I want to get to, simply because Brandt insists that historically the demand for freedom cannot be separated from the demand for equality, and that to do so is to speak in a very, very selective genealogy of Enlightenment thought and the history of modern politics. I think at that time the polarization and the reductive kind of opposition in the Cold War has hardened to such a degree that Brandt's words did not find a kind of fresh ear anymore. Just as one, I think, could speak in general about this sort of word with, that is so open to changing meanings and changing agendas, freedom, along with the other great words, sort of having settled into more or less institutionalized forms pertaining to capitalism, communism, perhaps anarchism, and other forms of socialism in these post-war decades, just in as much as many other discourses sort of were framed and institutionalized in rather inflexible forms. To a general movement, I think, that we also felt very strongly when working on this exhibition, that somehow even a lot of these artistic, art historical advancements and neo-avant-gardistic moves in fact do not quite perhaps deserve the kind of heroic history that they are often given in museum displays, but that actually the Cold War was a rather dull and period where one had to deal with reductive powers around the production of meaning that were not easily to be overcome. And the ways in which they were overcome are responsible to a large degree for the very forms and movements artists have produced in response. Often a response that kind of cast mimetic critique as a kind of very ambivalent form in itself. Just think of the way pop art, which was the art that truly conquered Europe rather than abstract expressionism, is a kind of mimetic critique of mass culture in the face of its overpowering presence. So it is a kind of adaptation to conditions that you can't fight anymore. And I think this is interesting also in relation to the pitfalls of this very form of critique in today's climate, where I think these kind of mimetic gestures cannot simply be claimed as critical anymore. Very argument around equality and freedom somehow resurfaces in an interesting way around the discussion of that widely discussed, influential book by sociologists Luc Boltanski and Yves Chapello, The New Spirit of Capitalism. In a 2007 review and critique of that book, that is written against the backdrop of the French struggles around social security systems, Maurizio Lazzarato strongly criticizes Chapello's and Boltanski's opposition of what they call the social critique versus the artistic critique, basically accusing them that they take the results of an ideological struggle, a scission between these two things, as a fact and project it back into history as if something like a social versus an artistic critique has actually existed through modern history. Social critique would be the critique that is linked to demands for solidarity, security, and equality, artistic critique being the very critique of capitalism that does not primarily demand security, equality, and solidarity, but instead freedom, autonomy, and authenticity. And the argument Boltanski and Chapello make is that particularly through the in the aftermath and directly inspired or instigated by the 68 students movement, that very form of critique, the artistic critique of capitalism, became a key historical actor in the establishment of the so-called neoliberal norms, and in sort of union together with the economic agendas of in the wake of Hayek and others, would serve as an argument basically against any sort of state intervention, more or less as being something that at least in tendency is already driving us towards totalitarian forms. Now, in working on this exhibition, it seems to me that as much as I follow Lazzarato's critique here and his point, which is basically to say that for any meaningful group of artists and that raised their voice politically, these very two demands, these forms of critiques were never separate. As much as I agree with that, and he makes the point very precisely by looking at how artists have raised their voice in contemporary France back then 10 years ago when the article was published, as much as is credible, somehow it seems to me that the argument of this very scission is completely justified in other terms when one looks at the history of the Congress for Cultural Freedom and the key figures that have kind of informed its discourse both politically and artistically, many of which in the 1930s were radicals, often members of the communist parties, or devoted to one or the other form of revolutionary politics, disenchanted with Stalinism through the 1930s, turned increasingly towards a form of liberalism that when you read Boltanski, Chapello, together with Lazzarato, might actually conform to that very idea of, I think, what Chapello, Boltanski called the Trojan horse, such that the ideas that they were putting forward, and I think this is it's crucial to, and you can see some of this documented in the exhibition, is that in the course of a magazine that is as brilliant and as sharp and as much tied to this kind of intellectual watershed moments of the 20th century as Partisan Review, a key organ of what came to be known as the New York Intellectuals, that many of these New York intellectuals who have started out as communists or socialist revolutionaries around the time of the Second World War, when they started to support American politics and the intervention into the war against the backdrop of their disillusionment with Stalinism and their radical opposition to it. And this is the context where the term cultural freedom was really coined and then prepared for its repurposing here in the Berlin context of the 1950s, that at the time, and in the 40s and even up until the early 50s, many of them were still adhering to the idea of establishing a third way or a socialist democratic alternative to the bloc confrontation, which is difficult to find, at least among those who have worked for or written in the organs of the Cultural Congress for Cultural Freedom just a few years later. I wanted to just hint to that in an interesting way, what survived of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, in a way that is not exactly what artists might have thought of their own work at the time, is perhaps this very scission between claims for freedom and claims for equality. In a sense that took often refuge in the anarchist definition of freedom, which was the position from which one could most brilliantly argue for instance, the alienated position of the modern individual, of the modern intellectual, but argue also against the very kind of character of modern mass society. And its extreme forms in the form of totalitarian regimes. Somehow that, even if this was definitely not the intention of these left liberals, it might have, history might have played out in such a way that what they were engineering, knowingly or unknowingly, and the majority, I think, unknowingly, but perhaps one could have known, with the support of the CIA, has given way to something that none of them was, or very few, very difficult to find anyone in the that would have supported these agendas in the 1940s. Their time was somehow over by the late 60s with the student movement, or by the late 70s with the rise of Thatcherism and Reagan, for sure. Some of them had turned into the ideologues of the neoconservatives by then, though by no means all. Some of them have never left Marxism, but definitely were formative for that which is known as cultural Marxism, which in itself might be in an interesting proximity to that, to engineering that very scission that Lazzarato speaks against and that Boltanski Cappello have argued for as a historical constant running through modern history. I think any look into the 30s confirms very much Lazzarato's point that these demands were by no way separable. In 1935, the surrealist response to the first Writers' Congress sponsored by the Soviet Union, and some of the debates, it would take me too long to go into detail, that were large there, and the first attempts to create this definition of cultural freedom were opposed in outspoken terms as meaningless, precisely somehow engineered through that term cultural, meaningless because cultural freedom as merely cultural has lost its substance. So I'm going to end with this. I know that it's maybe a bit unsatisfying, but it's just a line of thought that I hope to be able to continue with some of you. Thank you.